I was 30 when I found my way to the Triratna Center in Helsinki. It was FWBO in those days. And that was in September 1976. And it was a small flat in the center of town on third or fourth floor. Quite an ordinary little flat, really. But something quite special was going on in there. Just to give a bit of background, I had tried as a teenager, I had tried quite hard to be an evangelical Lutheran. I was very shy and nervous, and it didn't work out. I became rather cynical after that, but I kept looking around for spiritual alternatives. I had studied English at university. I loved that. I'd been to the USA for a year, which was very liberating. So I've seen some of the hippie culture of the 60s at first hand, the flower power. But in fact, I wasn't daring enough to drop out and experiment with drugs and become a real hippie. However, I was horrified by the thought of or the prospect of living a conventional life in the north of Finland. So what I'd done, I had married an English guy and had lived in London for 3 years, which I did enjoy. I'd done TM meditation for 5 years, but had got disillusioned with that. I had worked teaching English, teaching Finnish, working in offices and working in a library. After 3 years of married life, I had become very unhappy, realizing that I had got myself trapped in the English version of conventional life. I had in fact just tried to reject my Finnishness and be as English as possible to fit in the English society. But I always felt I was an outsider. I experienced guilt and shame about letting others down while desperately feeling that there must be more to life. And now I was in Helsinki for a trial separation from my husband and studying for my final exam of my second degree. I knew about this Buddhist center because I had met an ord member at a TM retreat. She was doing her own Buddhist thing on this retreat, which impressed me greatly. She definitely had something the others didn't, and I'm very grateful to her. So at that first class, my first metta bhavana, I found that meditation very different from TM, and I had something of a beginner's mind, I suppose. I had something like a cosmic experience, I felt. And I felt pretty immediately, oh, I found my spiritual home now. And the metta bhavana has always been very important practice for me since then. I've always found it easier than the mindfulness of breathing. I felt the atmosphere was very sober, but very vibrant, very lively. And it struck me that people there were very different from each other, people running it, they're very different to each other, but they had the same aim, same ideals. So I think that was my first inkling of Sangha, that it's possible to be individuals but not merge. So I threw myself in, and I was soon interpreting lectures on the Eightfold Path by an English ord member who was there temporarily visiting Finland and helping out the Randi Center, which has only started a couple of years earlier. Finland is a very small country. It's a very different culture from the rest of Europe. There are about 5 million people living in an area which is about the size of the UK. So you can imagine, it's very spacious. There's still unspoiled nature, forests, lakes. It's very beautiful in a Nordic kind of way. But these conditions have psychological implications. I think it's quite easy to feel isolated, separate, and it's quite hard to trust in connection with other people if you come from those connections, I feel. And it seemed to me that individualism is actually admired. And people are quite reserved and silent, but they can also talk an awful lot with great intensity, not always very appropriately. Well, they're also refreshingly direct, if not blunt. So, very briefly, that's the kind of national conditioning I feel I've had. It's very Protestant. When I was growing up, I think about 99% of Finns belonged to the church, which is part of the state. And I certainly, personally, have had to work quite hard on this national conditioning, which, of course, it goes very deep. It's quite unconscious, often. And it's not easy to change. So I found that Sangha Rakshita's teachings on the group and individual and group versus spiritual community have been really, really important to me, very helpful, and still are. So Finnish language is completely different from English. I'll give you a sample. Juuri tänä päivänä turvaudun voimakkaisiin suojelijoihin, joiden tehtävä on maailmankaikkeuden vartiointi, mahtaviin valloittajiin, jotka voittavat kärsimyksen kaikkialla. Samoin otan turvaksi bodhisattvojen joukot. This is, believe it or not, this is from the third section of the Sevenfold Puja. This very day I go for my refuge, etc. So the last sentence does not end in bodhisattva yogurt. It means the host of bodhisattvas. Well, it's natural to try and find something that you recognize in a foreign language. But when this was read in a puja recently at Tirnaloka, apparently some women found it hard to contain their giggles. But I was glad I didn't notice it at the time. So, after some months in Finland, I returned to London in December 1976. And I went to hear Sangha Rakshita. First time my chance to see Sangha Rakshita live. He gave his last lecture in a Sutra of Golden Light series. And this had a huge impact on me. It seemed to me he had enormous energy, and the golden light was just pouring through him. And I also noticed that there were many order members and mitras in the audience, and there seemed to be quite a large, vibrant sangha around him. And after that, I started going to classes and helping out at Pundarika, which was the only existing centre at the time in North London. And I think doing that, I began to understand a bit more about the Sangha. And the following year, I was back in Finland for a year and was active at the centre there. And in 1977, Sangha Rakshita came over to Finland and he did my mitra ceremony in September 1977. You've got a photo out there. One of the important things that happened in that time was that I was privileged to interpret for him once when he was giving a talk, a sort of informal talk at somebody's home. And it was quite extraordinary experience of almost like his mind was flowing through my mind. Something quite mysterious happened. And at this time I started living with other Buddhists and getting more and more involved with running things. So it has become obvious that so far that my Buddhist life has been in two cultures, in two languages. Sometimes this has been a source of conflict for me, but mainly I see it as enriching. I feel very fortunate to know English and be able to understand the original Sri Ratna language, read Sangharakshita in the original. But at the same time, going back to my roots and learning to practice the Dharma in Finnish has been very important. And as long as I can remember, communication has been a dominant theme in my life. And literature and creative writing have been very significant interests. I started writing poems in English at university, and doing workshops and even readings became part of my life later, when here in London in the 80s there was a poetry group around the LBC, and I got involved with that. And that was very important to me, even though I did go through a lot of self-doubt about the whole thing, because I wasn't writing in my mother tongue. And I haven't found it easy to trust that connection, communication does happen when I just share myself and forget myself. So it's not about it's not about words, just words. It's about sharing, communication. So I'll share you a poem called "Parents," which share with you, which will give you an idea about my childhood in a small village in Finland. When life was journeys between the little wooden school building and the white wooden house on the lakeside. The lake was a mother, a mysterious life giver, always there and generous with deep softness, always forthcoming with ideas for play, herself the richest of playgrounds. In summer, swimming and boating, we laughed and shouted as our feet relished the mud and the lily roots and were nibbled by baby fishes. In winter, she was solid and dependable and revealed her realm of ice stars and skating. Snow piled in drifts, froze into waves, and we went skiing. Built horses and castles and had snowball fights. All around the dark forest, golden brown and evergreen, was father-like. The spruce and pine, upright, straightforward, ancient, inviting us to investigate his height, his width, challenging us to brave the world. I experienced quite a lot of fear about asking for ordination, but gradually it got less, and I did ask, and I was ordained in August 1978. This was at the end of a 3-week open retreat on a small farm in Norfolk, which was called Mandarava. It was the very first women's retreat centre. Someone had transformed a chicken hut into a tiny little shrine room for the private ordination. It was a dark, starry night. Sangharakshita was sitting there waiting for me, I was quite nervous. So it took me a while to realize I was to make offerings to the shrine. He just waited, and time seemed to have stopped. He gave me the green Tara practice and told me that my name was also connected to Tara. That felt completely right. I had wanted to contemplate a female figure. Tara is beautiful and feminine and also very active, stepping out into the world with compassion. And she's also said to be a quick way to wisdom. So green Tara is my yidam. And I have done her visualization practice very regularly all these years. But I have also done other visualization practices later on. And at the moment, I'm alternating Mansha Ghosha with a male wisdom figure. And I'm doing Shakyamuni contemplation as well. And reflecting that Tara is expression of the Buddha's compassion, Mansha Ghosha's expression of Buddha's wisdom. I like my name very much. It sounded simple, but it contained much mystery. I did feel that it was my true name, and that something enormously significant had happened. I was also very excited. I was sharing a room with a woman who was being ordained as well, and I remember we found it quite hard not to whisper in the night to each other what our names were. But the next day the public ordination happened when the names were announced. So Sangharakshita came back to a retreat, and there were 9 women order members present, which was a record number those days. I think that was the total of women order members in Britain at the moment. And when the names were announced, I remember being very pleased to be a Devi. There was only one other woman in the order at that time who was a Devi, and she was my best friend. So becoming ordained had happened very quickly, and I didn't know many people. That was quite hard. But I knew her best, and she welcomed me with open arms after the ceremony. And she later became my Kalyanamitra. As the meaning of my name has been unfolding, I have tended to think of my Devi tendencies as me being rather dreamy, a bit ungrounded, and a bit impractical, and also not wanting to see the unpleasant side of life. Yeah, I've been reflecting recently that I haven't really wanted to look at suffering. I would much rather it wasn't there. But that is the main, in a way, that's the main thrust of the Buddha's teaching. Suffering and the way out of suffering, which is the greatest gift anybody could give you, because we all do suffer. There are infinite varieties and levels of it. But more positively, Devi is also connected to my interest in meditation and the arts. I do have a copy of a contemporary newsletter, Dakini, which tells you what Sangharakshita actually said at my public ordination. So I checked it when I was to give this talk. And he said that Devi means a shining one, whose degree of positivity is such that it shines and radiates. Shri means noble, holy, and auspicious. So, well, this sounds challenging enough to aspire to. But he added that Shri Devi is the name of a Buddha come Bodhisattva figure, Palden Lamo, in Tibetan. She's a form of Tara, but with the energy and vigor and determination not usually associated with Tara. For a long time, I was rather scared and mystified by this tantric figure. Then I gradually started finding out more about her. And there is a whole chapter on her in Meeting the Buddhas by Vesantra. She's a Dharmapala, a protector of the Dharma. So she's wrathful in appearance, dark blue and riding on a mule in a sea of blood. Surrounded by flames, her disheveled red hair is standing on end. It took me quite a few years, but these days I do find Balden Lamo an inspiring figure. Representing non-attachment, fearlessness, clarity, and confidence. Confidence in practicing and teaching the Dharma. And I do reflect often, what does protecting the Dharma mean? What could it mean to me? And I think best way to put it really is that I just need to be very clear about the Dharma and I need to practice it. That's the best way to protect the Dharma. After ordination, I was going to return to Finland, but I was asked to become the secretary of the LBC. This place was opening in 1979, and they needed a secretary, receptionist. I couldn't turn down such a good opportunity to work at what was called the biggest urban Buddhist center in Europe. With those experienced order members that were the team. And a couple of very interesting years in the East London followed in my life. I remember the old little office was there, and I was manning the office, and Chintamani was still painting the mural in the reception room. And in the evenings, of course, there were lots of classes, courses, festivals. We are establishing all this that happens here these days. I lived in a nearby community in a very basic conditions. It was all very hard work, but there was a spirit of pioneering, of enthusiasm and experiment. It was all very exciting. There's a lot of people, a lot of energy. And we felt that we were being very, very radical. It seemed almost like anything was possible. And Sangharakshita himself was very actively involved and dynamically involved at all levels. It was a privilege to be part of all that. And most of us also traveled in around the country and abroad, running retreats and events. I've got a short poem here about the LBC, but it's called The Mirror. After long travels on different continents, we pause in a channel, a thoroughfare, a room full of shoes. Left behind before entering the shrine, my hand rests in his for some moments only. From his eyes to mine flows a stream of light, shatters and unites. The crack in the mirror closes. I was also training to be an Iyengar yoga teacher, which meant attending lots and lots of classes and workshops and teaching on retreats. This was very important to me, as I had hated sports at school, and I felt quite ambivalent about my physical existence, in fact. But yoga was something that was quite possible for me to get involved in quite quickly. And another world opened up with some wonderful experiences. And doing lots of yoga helped me to relax and become more confident. I remember being quite amazed that people started thinking of me as a sporty kind of person. And I surprised myself too by taking up karate as well for 3 years. So this was, it was like shedding an old image of myself, on at least on a physical level. And that must have helped to loosen the deeper psychological habit of how I thought about myself, helped to loosen the first fetter of fixed self-view. I went to India the first time in 1981 to be taught by Iyengar himself and to go on a pilgrimage. We were 7 yogis from around the LBC, and I travelled afterwards to Kalimpong and the holy places with a Mitra. And this helped me to connect more with Shakyamuni Buddha and with Sangharakshita. The highlight was meeting one of his main teachers, Dado Rinpoche, in Kalimpong, and talking with him about my name. I came back from India to join a community of 8 women in West London who were establishing a whole food shop in Notting Hill. And there we were, of course, involved with the centre itself as well. And soon after my arrival, premises were found on Baker Street. We were really proud of that. We had lots of classes there. It was a small space on the top floor of an office building, which we called the BBC. This was my total immersion in the Buddhist lifestyle. Community living, right livelihood business, Dharma classes, retreats. One of the highlights at the center was Vasantara coming to give a talk on words and meaning in the life of Naropa. In that talk, he said how Sangharakshita had emphasized the importance of the imaginal faculty on a men's ordination retreat in Tuscany. He was thus back from there. And also, he says, one of the things he talks about is how it would be better to think in terms of verbs rather than nouns. So we fix things less. So he says it would be better to talk about Sridevi-ing. He warns us not to fix each other. Even the Buddhist names can become labels. So this was in 1983. We were already talking about the imaginal faculty. But I'm still listening to this talk. One of the seminal Dharma talks, I think. All this was extremely hard work, especially as I was doing yoga and karate training as well. But we were young and it was exciting. It was exciting even though we didn't make much money, so we were really poor. However, when the community had moved 4 or 5 times from one short life house to another, it started to disintegrate. Moving 8 women frequently was stressful, and some of the houses were pretty grim, very, very cold. But here's a happy poem written in one of those cold houses. A cold winter's day. Huddling too close to a fire, my transistor radio becomes a melting object. Still singing. A song like a coal drops into a glowing, flowing space in me. Deep, without warning. The sun breaks in through cloud, glass and curtain. I catch myself in a tall mirror. my eyes smiling. Happiness has entered without warning. Until 1985, women had to do retreats in rented premises. We did have some memorable retreats in various boarding schools. But that year, 1985, energetic fundraising by some intrepid women had produced enough money, and a farm in Shropshire was bought. Taraloka was established and is still thriving. I was there last week on retreat, and I was remembering the many retreats I've been on there through the years. Some have been wonderful, some have been difficult, and some less dramatic. But here's a poem. This is a rather dramatic. It's called Shipwrecked in Shropshire. Unsuspecting, though knowing it had always been there, I hit an iceberg in the wide fields of Shropshire. My little boat fights it rebelliously. My big ships launched against it crash into white hardness. Ice and dark water surround me. No knowledge of how deep the mysterious obstacle can reach, loom how large. When the fleet is in splinters sinking through the waters, dissolved into waves and endless waves into nothing, no shelter. I am alone with the iceberg, its size and powers unknown and too familiar. It is everything I have, to fight, to ignore, to avoid. Only the sun from above can melt it. So, I was reflecting last week, and particularly after the retreat, I realized that when I was looking at the old poem, that actually this is still going on. It just gets more subtle. And really that poem is about suffering, and suffering caused by the sense of self, the ego. So in a way, the iceberg could be a symbol for the ego that I just keep fighting or trying to ignore. But what I really need to do is to just look at it, be aware, see it, let it dissolve. So if there wasn't the self, the sense of self, there wouldn't be any suffering. That's what causes suffering in any situation, big or small. Anyway, next, Sangharakshita asked me to move to Norwich and work with him, responding to the numerous women who wrote to him, usually in longhand, very long letters. And it was quite a privilege to see him once a week. I went to Padmaloka to do this correspondence and to get to know him much more. It was also an opportunity to work on my relationship with my teacher, which has always been rather complicated for me. I do think that it is hard to learn to relate appropriately to a spiritual teacher, because we have no tradition for that in modern culture, modern Western culture. I have struggled with projection, for instance. But while in Norwich, I was writing quite a lot myself, journals and poetry. There was an active poetry group, and Sangharakshita has always been very encouraging about my writing. But I find solitary retreats are the best times for writing for me. Solitary retreats have been very, very important to me in many ways. And I have tried to go on one almost every year. I have managed it most years. It's not easy to find conducive places for them, But from Norwich, I remember I travelled down to Shoreham, near Brighton, where a Mitra let me use her houseboat. That was quite a unique solitary. I had been having quite a tough time. So I remember walking on the beach and watching the tides and writing lots of poetry. But here's a very, very short one called Shoreham. Shells, pebbles, skulls and bones. I play like a child with my many lives and shout at the sea. A garland I will make with them. When Sangharakshita didn't need me anymore in Norwich, I decided to move to Bristol and get a straight job in a nursing home. I was 42, and now I was getting interested in aging and death, which I had not wanted to think about at all until then. I was also having something of an identity crisis around the 10th anniversary of my ordination. I liked Bristol and the Sangha there. However, there were no women order members. There were lots of nice men, but no women order members at all. And I did realize how important they are for me. Now I was also realizing more deeply that I had rejected my roots. And there was much integration to be done, a return journey to be made. And when an opportunity arose in 1991 to get a job and a flat in Helsinki, I decided to move to Finland permanently. I worked at the university library. I worked as a manager of the Buddhist Center and later as a home carer for the elderly. It was good to think about the Dharma in Finnish, to translate texts, to teach yoga and Dharma classes and retreats in my mother tongue, to make friends in the Finnish Sangha. So 14 years passed, and now I was about almost 60, and I thought I would not live abroad again. However, in 2005, I was invited to join the ordination training team at the Ratnaloka Retreat Centre in Wales. And I thought this was too good an opportunity to miss. And I am very, very grateful for the 6 years at the Ratnaloka. I've been there. It has been a very thorough training for me in many ways. A training in harmonious community living, in leading retreats as a team, in looking after this big building. And living at home at the same time as being on retreat has been very instructive. I think it has really helped me not to divide my existence so much into mundane and spiritual, which has been quite a theme for me all my life. And it's been a training in teaching the Dharma, learning to question more, to clarify the principles of the Buddha's teaching and Sangharakshita's approach to it. A training in understanding and elucidating to others the principles of this order Sangharakshita has founded. What is ordination? Why get ordained? It's very good to explore this over and over again with wonderful women who keep coming. But perhaps the most significant thing that has happened to me in my time at Tirunaloka is that I became a private preceptor. I found this quite a transition to make because I was so used to all those years thinking that it was Sangharakshita who ordained people. And so many years I couldn't imagine anybody else doing it, and me doing it was the last thing I could imagine. So it was quite a leap in faith and confidence I had to make. But of course I was in the best place to learn about precepting at Tirunaloka. And last year I went to Akashavana first time to ordain someone. And more recently some Scandinavian women have asked me to be their preceptor. And it is a wonderful privilege, a unique privilege, to be able to witness someone's commitment to practicing the Dharma, and in this particular spiritual community. And it was an experience, a very strong experience, a feeling that I am a link in the lineage all the way to the Buddha. And when I arrived at Akashavana, the women had been practicing there 2 months, I think, already. It occurred to me that this mysterious thing that we are all involved in, Tri Ratna community, practicing the Dharma, in one way it's just really simple. You just keep practicing and the level of positivity rises. Because the first thing that occurred to me when I arrived was that you could just feel the positivity there that was so strong, it was so tangible, you could almost touch it in the air. And this must be quite rare in the world. Well, of course, there are always challenges and obstacles to work with. And I gave a short talk at Akashavana. We were giving talks on going forth in body, speech and mind. So when I thought about it there, what I came up with for the mind was that I aspire to go forth from literal mindedness, polarized thinking, and over seriousness. So those are some things that I also have worked quite hard over the years. Now we come to the present day, and once again I'll be making the return journey to Finland on the 12th December this year. I will be involved with the Helsinki Buddhist Center again. I'll be a pensioner. I hope to be translating Dharma texts, giving Dharma talks, leading classes, retreats in Finnish. Maybe even write poetry in Finnish again. It's very sad to leave Tri Ratnaloka and these excellent conditions for practice in this country. But I look forward very much to seeing my family, particularly my elderly mother, and being with the Finnish Sangha. And I look forward to lots of snow and warm houses. It hasn't been snowing very much in Wales, but last year we did have quite a bit. And I thought I'd finish off just reading this poem that I wrote after a snowy day. It's called White Magic. My Wellingtons, a gift from an old Finnish woman, now likely to be dead, were white before the snow came. Sheep were white in green fields, and the roads were black. Now whiteness envelops all, showing up brown. But the top of the big brown mountain has become a white luminous space where life and death mingle. Mountain and sky have renounced separateness. The grey mossy tombstones reach up from the snow, wanting to announce the dead are on the mountain, luminous and dancing with dove's feathers. Thank you.